Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Sequential Heart, and I'm really sorry, we're kind of late on this one.
Sean, it's almost like you've had a lot going on lately.
Well, last week I was at New York Comic Con, and I got to host a panel. That was kind of magical. And besides that, yeah, life's just kind of been churning around.
Did I hear you got some new family too?
I do have a new nephew, to say the least, so it's someone to get addicted to comics ASAP.
Wow, man, that's funny. Yeah, I was hanging out with my two baby nephews. I guess one's literally a baby and the other's about two. And I was talking to my brother about comics they should get into, and he's a Marvel guy. So he's like, hey, I know you're typically DC. Let's go Marvel with these guys.
You know, the cool thing right now is that Marvel actually has a lot of great comics for kids. They just released Champions by Mark Waid. And it's literally about the new generation of kid superheroes taking over. There's actually a new college-aged Iron Man, or should I say Iron Woman, coming in named Riri Williams. So Marvel is definitely doing a good job of targeting younger readers.
Let's get back to your trip to New York City. You're a pretty sophisticated drinker. What did you have while you were there?
You know, the coolest thing was that Robert Kirkman actually had a Walking Dead party. And it was hosted by Johnny Walker Black.
And for each guest,
they gave you a backpack filled with a tent, a multi-tool, a solar iPhone charger, and then a full bottle, a big bottle of Johnny Walker Black. But the drinks they had there, I don't even know if I can describe them, but they were intensely good.
What's up, Mr. Kick-Ass? Mr. Rubber Burner?
It was a really good time. I got to talk to him, and nice guy. And he doesn't drink, ironically.
I thought they kind of like based Negan after him.
They might have, but I doubt it. He just kind of seemed very gentle. I'm sure he knows how to manage a company very well, as he has his own comic imprint. But he seemed pretty mellow.
Oh, yeah. Skybound's awesome.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I would have to say the Johnny Walker Black cocktails they had at that party were probably the apex of my drinking at New York Comic Con.
Johnny Walker Black was what made me love scotch, and scotch is my drink. So, like, I have a hard time believing that anything could be better than just scotch in a glass.
And the interesting thing is I gave it to the person I was staying with because I'd have to check my bag, but I forgot to take out the multi-tool, which has a knife in it. So security definitely nailed me on that. But they were actually really friendly so that they kind of understood the situation, even if it seemed a little bit far-fetched.
Wow.
So I was like, no, it was a gift from the guy who did Walking Dead. He gave me a knife and a backpack. Really? I'm not trying to do anything.
Everybody got complimentary crossbows.
Yeah, he was like, oh, you're in the cast of The Walking Dead? I'm like, no, I'm press, but just as good.
Okay, so let's get back to Sequential Heart here. So we have a really unique talk coming up. It's a talk that you did, Sean, while you were at NYCC. It's with a creator that I don't really know very well.
Box Brown.
Box Brown. Tell us about Box Brown.
He's a really cool, ambitious indie creator. He has his own publishing label called Retrofit Big Planet. And he takes all these amazing indie artists like Eleanor Davis, and he publishes kind of these one-and-done short comics. But he also does longer works. So one of my favorites was the Andre the Giant bio. And that was by First Second, who actually I did the moderating panel for. That's a great publisher that does a nice range of kids and adult stuff. And Box's latest piece for them is a biography of the guy who did Tetris.
Wait. You mean the real life person who invented the video game Tetris?
Yeah. And it's cool because he starts out very philosophical, kind of talking about what games do for us and how they engage us. And how Tetris is kind of the perfect video game. How it like stimulates your frontal cortex by solving these, you know, these puzzles and then immediately introducing a new one. And how like the entire current generation of video games deal with that kind of formula of and they monetize it right now. But he says that basically Tetris is the perfect experience, the perfect gaming experience. He also goes on to talk about sort of the politics behind that game, because it was made by the Russians during the Cold War, so they were more socialist, and how that segued into dealing with Nintendo and the Americans and licensees. So it's a deceptively simple game that has an entirely complex history and philosophy behind it.
How much of a video gamer are you?
I try to treat it like anything else, because I feel like it can be a bigger time suck. I really go for innovation, which might be hard because they're introducing virtual reality, but I think deep at heart, I follow like Tim Schafer from Double Fine. Those guys are favorites. And I really like the Fables games from back in the day, and then From Software. So, you know, the Dark Souls and the Bloodborne's. So those are kind of my jams. How about you, man?
Not really. I have like 1,000 irons in the fire at any given point. And honestly, video games were like the one that I had to just draw the line at.
Yeah. It's something where I have to very carefully delineate how much time something will take. So I kind of dig the shorter games. I'll play like The Journey or The Flowers.
Yeah.
Which are kind of indie games. Or Gone Home. I don't know if you're familiar with these. Kind of the more narrative, I would say maybe intellectual side of video gaming. So it's only about 2 hours. So it's the equivalent of a movie, which makes it a little bit easier.
Okay. I caught the very tail end of the actual arcades when I was a kid. So like the birthday parties that we had when I was a kid were actually at the arcades where they would just turn the games on cheat mode and you could just play Rampage or Ninja Turtles indefinitely.
Yeah, I think that's where Box actually kind of operates from a point of nostalgia too.
Yeah, exactly.
He does that beautifully in his book. And even he has like a kind of monochrome with spot coloring that's yellow. It kind of reinforces that that aesthetic of the Game Boy, because the Game Boy was just kind of like black and green. And now he has black kind of page color and yellow as well.
Yeah.
And we're talking before, you know, you had all these colors and all these bits in these video games. So I think you might dig Tetris.
I do remember playing Tetris a lot. And I have this, not OCD, because like you've been to my house, you know how untidy it is. But when I focus in on something, I get that like, oh my God, I got to do it all mentality. It is a really, at the same time, frustrating but really fulfilling game. And Box talks about that too. Like, play has been such an important part of the human experience. Not just kids. I mean, it rolls over into every aspect of human life.
Well, I mean, it's practice for reality to a certain point. It's an environment where you can invest yourself without feeling the true repercussions that could happen if those behaviors were demonstrated outside of your own bedroom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so we have a really awesome talk with Box Brown coming up. But first, every week, Sean and I talk about some stuff that's coming out that we're really into. So Sean, there's one coming out this week that I'm really excited about, and it is so perfectly timed for me. On my TV, right this very second, I can see the screen. I have The Lost Boys on pause.
This is a conversation that exclusively revolves around 80s nostalgia.
Exactly. I had a cool older sister. She graduated in 89, and she was, she was 9 years older than me. So when I was a little kid, I got to absorb all this amazing 80s culture with her. And probably the thing that like I've carried with me the most is horror. Because she loved horror movies, and so she would take me to see all these movies that were just horrifying to me as a little boy. And now, like literally just last night, I finally worked up the nerve to watch Silver Bullet again for the first time in like 20-some years. And so following the Corey Haim train here, I'm watching Lost Boys right now. And there's a Lost Boys book coming out this week. It's Tim Seeley.
He's no stranger to the genre.
So he's picking up kind of right after the movie. So it's the two brothers, and then it's Edgar and Alan, the two guys from the comic shop that are the vampire hunters. So this is like their next batch of exploits. And I haven't read this yet, but this is probably the one that's going to go, I wanted to say first on my list, but I save the book that I'm the most excited about for last every week.
Tim Seeley also does the art books for Dark Horse for He-Man. So he has a lot of 80s love going on. But I have the comic. I haven't read it. But I will say that if he doesn't have the saxophone player from the live show.
Oh my God, was that ridiculous or what?
And the ponytail, like that is my favorite part of the movie, but also I hope they have the perspectives where you have the victim looking ahead and you see them flying, but not really. If they can replicate that, I'm totally down with this book.
Okay, Sequential Heart listener, pause this podcast right now and look up the saxophone guy from the band in the movie.
If you could distill an entire decade into like a minute of film footage, it is that saxophone player without a shirt. Does he have suspenders on?
No, just
shirtless and like a ponytail.
Oiled down ponytail, some leather drawers.
Yeah. Yeah, by far the best thing about that movie. Going a little bit into the future, but not really, because we have another vampire comic that spans centuries, is we also have American Vampire Anthology 2. So Scott Snyder and Raphael Albuquerque have a pretty nice postmodern look at bloodsuckers, aka looking at the American incarnation of them. And sometimes they let their friends kind of come in and write stories in this universe. So we have previous Sequential Heart guests like Steve Orlando, Karen Gillan, and then some other great new additions like Marguerite Bennett and Joelle Jones. So definitely going to be checking out that too.
Okay, so what else is coming out that you're excited about?
Oh man, it's a big week. So besides Tetris, which we're basing this episode around, so we have Troll Bridge, which is Colleen Duran illustrating and adapting Neil Gaiman's short story into a comic. And it's great. It kind of has that weird bittersweet mix of fantasy with real life regret and retrospect. And a great ending, just an amazing ending. And then Rolling Blackouts, which is Sarah Glidden. It's her look at the Middle East as a journalist. I've yet to read this, but we are going to post an interview with Sarah pretty soon. Incredibly intelligent, incredibly provocative, and incredibly engulfing is what I've seen of this graphic novel. So definitely worth checking out. That's from Drawn and Quarterly.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I also find it very interesting that there's a new series coming out called Warlords of Appalachia, coming out the same time as Great Lakes Avengers.
Sure.
And man, think about the crossover possibilities.
I just know that New York and Los Angeles get way too much play. There's so much country in between where so much is going on. Like, I don't know what the Great Lakes Avengers are going to fight. Maybe algae?
I heard the river could catch on fire.
Like the amoebas that are kind of being hosted in the hot water from the pollution. That's a thing. In Appalachia, I don't know, man. It kind of seems like we're in a phase where that's become a little bit more sexy.
Maybe they go to some Cleveland Browns games, and that would just be too depressing. Never mind. That's real life. I don't need that in comics, damn.
Well, if they had a comic equivalent of The Green Room, you know that movie about the punk band that played in West Virginia, and they turned out to be neo-Nazis? If they had a comic version of that, I would be all about it. It's kind of like the new millennial rendition of Deliverance.
Well, I mean, I've lived in Pittsburgh, and I've lived in Columbus, but I've lived in sketchy neighborhoods in both of those cities, and
sure,
that does not scare me at all. As soon as I get out in the hills, things get weird.
We should have a road trip podcast.
Sequential Heart, world tour.
A few other things coming out. We have the final Hellboy and Helltrade paperback coming out. So I'm sure Eric and I have talked enough about Hellboy to give you the message that we're clearly enamored with this man and his art.
Yep.
And Doom Patrol 2, Jared Way's take on the classic early Vertigo work of Grant Morrison. And the first issue was great. Can't wait to read what's going on there. So that's about it for me right now, to be honest.
You know, the only other thing I want to add is there's a new James Bond story coming out. I mention it every time. But man, Warren Ellis did a great job. Andy Diggle's taking on the next James Bond story. It's called Hammerhead. It comes out this week. If you're a huge fan of espionage stuff and specifically James Bond, or just good drinks, might be worthwhile.
Shaken, not stirred. And I love Warren Ellis. I'll be looking forward more so as he reignites the Wildstorm universe in February. Big news from the con. So if you liked The Authority, if you liked Wildcats, if you liked any of those books, I cannot wait to see what he does with that.
Yep. All right. So enough of us yammering on here. Let's get to the reason we were doing Sequential Heart, which is to talk to creators about what drives their work and what drives their art. So while he was at the NYCC, Sean got to talk to Box Brown about Tetris, his new book, and not just his new book, man, you guys talk about all kinds of stuff. You guys even talk about WWF wrestling on artistic terms as classical music. Blew my mind.
Well, that's Box. He's way more intelligent than I am. I mean, yeah, you know, just go ahead. Go and listen to the interview and listen to Box. He's amazing. Here with Mr. Box Brown. Box, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. We're big fans of your work. And Tetris was just released?
Yeah, just came out, or it's coming out here at New York Comic Con.
Yeah, so let's talk about this a little bit, because I look at your recent works and I see what I would interpret as a clear adoration of the 80s between Andre and less overt, but An Entity Observes All Things.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So what's your relationship to that era?
I have lots of nostalgia for it. I really don't even... I've actually contemplated doing a book on the concept of nostalgia, because I find it to be so mysterious. Like when I look at up stuff on eBay, I have like this really specific things that I'm looking for, and it like satisfies me in such a weird way, where I'm like, okay, has to be between the years of 1979 up to 1987. Anything before or after that, it's probably not going to hit, scratch the itch.
Right.
It's really strange. Like, for whatever reason, I was at the right age to anything that happened in those years, I see as like comforting, or I'm just interested. I like it a lot.
Well, the cool thing about Tetris is it encompasses so much about that era. So on one hand, we have philosophy of games that like goes back hundreds of years. We have the politics of bureaucracy. There's almost, you could actually dissect this from a perspective of capitalism versus socialism or communism as well.
Yeah.
So when you approach this and we're slinging everything into such a holistic level, what was that process like?
So a lot of times when I'm considering some kind of universal concept like gaming,
right?
I try to go back to like as the beginning of time with it, because since the longevity of games, you know, we think of video games as like a pretty, and it is like a pretty recent phenomena, but people have been playing games since the dawn of time, right?
Right.
So there's something there that is innately human, right? And so I wanted to approach that, you know, from that perspective, right? Like, we have this something in us that makes us want to play games, like starting at almost birth, right?
Right.
And then, you know, I started to think about games as art, and you know, it's like like the Andre book, for instance. Like, pro wrestling and video games both carry with them still like a stigma. And I'd like to, but what they really are art forms, and I feel like they deserve the respect, the same respect we have, the reverence we have for classical music or the Beatles or classic paintings and all this stuff. I feel like they're completely valid, and in some ways the most important fields of art of our time, especially video games. I mean, it's one of the most immersive types of art form, and it's the most popular right now. It's more popular than movies. It makes more money than movies. So, but still, you'd have to be, for certain people, hard-pressed to describe it as art.
So one thing about Tetris and your art style that I kind of saw as being very similar was this reliance on the beauty of strong and simple design. There's almost a strong correlation between that aesthetic approach and also your illustrative approach.
Yeah.
Is that intentional, or did you just see that?
No, it was like totally accidental. So before I started working on Tetris, I had already started kind of experimenting with geometry in comics. So I was really getting used to using rulers like nonstop.
Right.
Before I did Tetris. And my interest in Tetris was purely the social or the subject matter, and not from an artistic standpoint. It just was like a happy accident that it worked out, because it's like all straight lines and geometry. It's very similar. It's weird that way. It was like Kismet or something.
Yeah. But I mean, taking that idea a little bit further, and I have to look at my notes to be able to articulate this, is when you were talking about how Tetris is kind of the perfect game for how it kind of resolves micro-conflicts being proposed and solved in a very specific rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't help but kind of draw a parallel to your own work in structure of setting up storylines as well. Mm. Is that something that came across your mind through self-awareness as well?
No. I mean, I think that that's an interesting observation, but... it's, you know, Tetris is all about like finding, you're given a problem, a piece at the beginning, and you have to place it on a unique landscape that changes every time. And in a way, that is kind of how I approach stories because, I chose the subject matter of Tetris, but then I have to force it into comics. You
right.
know what I mean? It is. I do see it as like a not a problem, but just a thing that you have to that needs to be solved.
That needs resolution.
Yeah, yeah.
From a conflictual point of view, whether you're lining something up yeah. or whether you're, you know, doing it with a plot point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is, yeah, I mean, like, that is my approach to comic making, for sure.
Or, yeah, we're all stories going to a certain degree. Yeah. But especially that, like, that rhythm of, I love how you basically have your long-form narrative, which is, you know, Alexei. I'm not even going to try to pronounce his last name.
Pajinov. Yeah.
And you know, he gets screwed over so much through the end, and that's the macro structure. But I love it how you're able to satiate the reader and those little moments before as well with all these little micro conflicts that kind of populate the entire book.
Yeah, I think a lot of my work is about creating, finding humanity in all the characters. And I really try to put myself in everyone's shoes when I'm writing for them.
Oh, there's some assholes in this book too.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, like, they're motivated by making money. Like, they have their even, like, the assholes, right? You have to figure out what they're motivated by.
Right.
And you know, I tried to give them all an even hand. But at the same time, like, certain characters, you can't help but be like, okay, this guy's a bad guy.
Yeah, I mean, it was bizarre how much, like, there had a sense of traditional foils and heroes in this.
It's really true. I mean, I think I wasn't used to working with so many characters. You know, a lot of my work, even my short fiction and stuff, always is based around a singular character's mm-hmm. point of view. So when I was working with Tetris, this was like a new thing for me to have like 10 main characters or 10 different characters or more than that you had to, you know, get straight and get situated. So the first thing I did when I was working on this book was make like a huge family tree with all these different characters on it and how they were connected to each other.
Sure.
Just for my own personal reference to keep that straight. And the family tree didn't end up making into the book, but all those pages where it's just the character's profile in between the chapters was from that. And it's there to help you keep the character straight. Who's who? Who do they represent?
Oh, wow,
it's very
yeah.
difficult. A lot of them are just all white, old white guys and stuff, so there's like not too many defining characteristics.
Well, the most interesting thing is how you went from something so conceptual and philosophical to the most intricate levels of deal-making and bureaucracies of, like, I don't know, proto-gaming business.
Yeah.
By the end of that book, I mean, that had to be months of research.
I mean, you know, there's only so many stories of Tetris out there. I mean, you know, talk about that specifically. And I was able to talk to a few people to kind of like round out the story.
Did you get to talk to any of the original sources or people on it?
I didn't get to talk to Alexei or Hank. I wish I could have, but I didn't. But I was able to talk to Gilman Louie, who was involved in a lot of the business aspects of it from an early standpoint. He was extremely helpful. I talked to him later. When the book came out, I sent him a copy and stuff. And he works for, his big investment now is Niantic, who just did Pokemon Go. So he was like, when he worked on Tetris, now he's working on Pokemon Go. And it was like, that was when it first came out. And it was like an enormous, ridiculous hit. Everybody in my neighborhood is playing it. So it was awesome that they stopped to talk to me. And the other cool thing was talking to him was that a lot of these guys that work in gaming are just old school, huge gaming fans. Like, these guys were pioneers of this business in the way. You know, and it's hard to think about that now. I mean, if you look at like the big, huge gaming companies now, it's hard to think of them as pioneers or as artists or something like that. But you know, this is really like the beginning of all that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have to ask. So I know you have James Kolchaka do a lot of stuff for you at Retrofit, and I know that he is also a nostalgic gamer. Was he involved in the articulation of this process at all, or is that just an extreme coincidence?
No. I think that I talk to him pretty often about games all the time. Like, we're always like texting back and forth what are the good new like iPad games and stuff like that. But I think that there's a comic that he did in a book called The Cute Manifesto, where he talks about it's about games and how the humans interact with them. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time, and I remember that came out in like the late 2000s or something like that. And I remember reading that, and that was the first time I had considered the concept of games as art. So in that way, it was very influential on the book.
Looking back at kind of looking at Tetris as the perfect, most simple distillation of the gaming concept, mm-hmm. do you think the developments and the innovation that's come have helped or hindered the human connection to video games?
Okay, so one of the things I think that you see with Tetris, that whole like giving you a task, solving the task thing, which was stumbled upon kind of by Alexei, has now been game creators realize that that's a thing.
Sure.
So I feel like some of these games now that you play are so taking advantage of that and maximizing that, that I feel like it almost feels like a scam, some of the games.
Are you thinking more of the iPhone era or the AAA games or both?
I'm thinking a lot of these iPhone games that use like algorithms to kind of like, it's all like the tapping games.
Right.
That's what I think of. That's just like, it's a game, but it's almost purely about this reward system.
Right.
And I think that, so like that was kind of discovered via Tetris. You know
right.
what I mean? Like that whole concept. You know, that type of stuff, super weird. Like I think that, some games take advantage of it to such a point that it's detrimental. But puzzle games are great, you know what I mean? And
sure.
there's been all kinds of great ones since Tetris. I mean, even looking back at, like, Dr. Mario probably wouldn't exist without Tetris.
No, not
Dr. Mario is a great game. But, I mean, even if you look at that, compare it to Tetris, right? It's got storyline. It's got characters. And those things... the lack of that in Tetris is what makes it such like an amazing universal game.
It's so apolitical.
Yeah.
Well, and we talk about that in the book,
it
too.
It should be apolitical,
right.
but they injected politics in it.
Yes.
In the marketing.
I would have never known.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the marketing. And it's actually like, in a way, like, you know, I feel like Tetris would have been a hit anyway, but the Russian marketing helped. I mean, it was really something that... It seems weird looking back on it now where you're like, oh, they just made this thing Russian to, you know, make it seem something bad is coming out or something scary.
Yeah.
But the at the time, U.S. had a fascination with Russia. Like, it was our 50-year enemy. And, like, there was, at this point in the late 80s, there was Glasnost, Gorbachev, and Reagan were talking. And there was, like, these... You know, we were getting interested in the Russian way of life. I mean, you look at things from, like, that era. We have, like, Rocky IV, right?
Right.
Like, that's all about the difference between America and Russia. And, like, that's, you know, that revived the Rocky franchise.
Red Dawn, any of that.
Yeah, Red Dawn is another great example of it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is not... It's rather genius that they were able to tie Tetris to this wave... Of almost
such a Cold War coincidence.
Yeah, it was like a wave of Russia files, you know, people that were just interested in the weird and the difference how, because they were competing with us, but they do things so differently.
Do we even have a relationship like that today? That seems like such an anomaly.
I don't think so. I mean, the Cold War was strange because it was like Russia was our enemy, but also more like a rival. It would be like. You know, two amazing athletes push each other to get better.
In space, too, in the space program, yeah.
It's almost like, you know, when WCW was...
I love it. I love how everything goes back to a wrestling.
When WCW was really challenging WWF, and it really made both shows better, and in the long run, WWF better.
Right.
And that was kind of what it was like with Russia in the 80s. Like, we were really, you know, in the 60s, it was very much like nuclear war. And the space race and stuff, but by the 80s, it was really like a almost friendly rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was all kinds of stuff back then. Like every sitcom did an episode where the Russian chess champion comes to. You know, like I'm thinking of Saved by the Bell, where like the Russian champion comes and they learn how to play chess, and then in the end they become friends. Like
right.
I think Family Ties did something similar like that. So this theme was throughout that time period for sure.
Very cool. So if I can ask, first, what video games are you currently playing?
Okay, so I recently got an iPad. I never had one for like a long time.
Right.
But I have this book tour that I'm going on, so and I needed it for presentations and stuff.
Quote unquote.
Yeah, it was definitely a business expense, but also I was always like, I have an iPhone. I play games on my iPhone. What's the big difference? And then you get the iPad, and it's like you have a freaking PlayStation in your hand, you know? So I started playing a bunch of I got the old Final Fantasy games. I have Final Fantasy VII on there. But my favorite game right now that I'm, like, addicted to is Crashlands.
I'm not familiar.
Okay, so Crashlands is a iPad game where you're like, a guy that lands on a planet, and you have to start harvesting all the resources to develop different devices. It's really like, the map is enormous. It's like this huge display map. I feel like, I never played Minecraft, but I feel like there's some elements from Minecraft in it where you're sourcing these different things and building a house and all these different stuff.
Right.
So I'm like addicted to it.
Well, what you just said made me think of something. Think about the psychology and the philosophy of games. You notice like the walking simulators, because what you just said reminded me of No Man's Sky.
Uh-huh.
And you think of like Firewatch. Are those the antithesis of this type of Tetris game?
I mean, there are, you know, it's much less specific tasks than there, right? And you're kind of just, it's like the sandbox style games, you mean? Like,
well, but even like with, you know, you're thinking about something like, you know, Grand Theft Auto, where it gives you like these missions. These don't have those missions.
Yeah.
It's so open-ended. I'm curious what appeals to human psychology.
Yeah.
And Tetris kind of solidifies that. What's up with these games?
I don't know. You know, I'd have to play a lot more of them. But I agree that it's like almost the complete opposite of a Tetris game, where it's like constant directed tasks. You know, I think that something will develop from these games. You know, keep pushing into new genres. No Man's Sky was kind of a flop, I guess. Like, I haven't played it. But
I know James plays it a lot.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people are not really, or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, people are always down on new stuff, right?
They really are.
I mean, like, think about when Nintendo first came out. People would be like, "That's a kid's toy," you know, whatever. I'm not playing that. And now look at it. I mean, you can clearly see all the worth of all these things. So I think that's something that's like in flux right now, but sooner or later there's going to be a game that comes out even further. I mean, you look at like all these kids playing Minecraft now, when they're 18, 19, 20, what are they going to be coming up with? I mean,
right.
This is art, you know?
Yeah,
this
absolutely.
Is how things progress. You know, people build off one another, they push this kind of classical approach, and then sometimes it crashes, and then you have like the punk rock, you know, that development, and like that's anti everything else, and they develop something else. And I think we're in such an awesome period of time, like the forefront of this, because games are so huge and it's easy to become a creator, and it's easy to get into that. So we're going to see all kinds of amazing games in the next 20 years.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what are you reading right now as far as comics are concerned?
I am actually reading this amazing book that Fantagraphics put out called Highbone Theater. It's like a 500-600-page graphic novel by this South African cartoonist named Joe Daly, who did a series called Dungeon Quest, which was great.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I love his work. It's kind of like Charles Burns art style-wise, but it's like so foreign to me. It's like reading, you know, when you read somebody's work from Australia, it's like there's something different about their sensibilities from the average U.S. person or something like that. So this guy being from South Africa, you know, he you know, writes everything in English, but his, you know, and you think of South Africa as super similar to the U.S., but there's slight differences and stuff in culture and his writing that's just fascinating to me, because it's always just different than the way that I would do it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, anything that you can talk about that's coming out next for you?
I can't really mention what the next book is, but there is another book coming. I actually just put the finishing touches on it this past weekend. So
sure, sure.
I was like trying to get it done before the Tetris book tour. So we have that to look forward to.
Okay. And also looking forward to everything coming out from Retrofit Big Planet.
Oh, yeah. We have a bunch of awesome books coming out for Retrofit. We just put out an Eleanor Davis book called Libby's dad, which
it's
was
great.
Which was amazing.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And we had this other book called Our Mother, which was amazing too. And you know, I love working with and doing retrofit and being an editor, because it scratches like some other itch besides, like I feel more passionate about the production and design of these things because that's where I come in, you know?
Right.
And I really like championing small and short works because, you know, graphic novel is the preeminent art form, but it's really difficult to make a graphic novel and it takes a long time. And I think short stories often get short shrift. So I'm trying to make a place for those.
Very cool.
Retrofit.
Box, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers.
All right. So I, for one, ate my heart out that I wasn't at the NYCC. But I was here at my house working on the next Sequential Art podcast. So we want to give a big thanks to Box Brown. Man, that was a great talk. And wow, his influence goes so much deeper than just comics. I mean, this guy has a wealth of influence.
And the cool thing about that observation is that definitely applies to our next guest too. So I will openly admit to being ignorant about manga, Japanese comic books, but I think our next guest has done the most to sort of incorporate those influences and aesthetic into something that's wildly American while still retaining some of those roots. So I won't spoil it, even though you could probably guess it, but I'm a huge fan of her, and she'll be coming up soon.
All right. Thanks a lot for listening. My name's Eric.
And this is Sean.
Be with us next week.